The only date in the Constitution is January 20th. So we have more than enough time to right the wrong of this fraudulent election result and certify Donald Trump as the winner of the election. As we speak today, an alternate slate of electors in the contested states is going to vote, and we're going to send those results up to Congress. This will ensure that all of our legal remedies remain open. That means that if we win these cases in the courts, that we can direct that the alternate slate of electors be certified. The state legislatures in Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania can do the same. And likewise, Congress has that opportunity as well to do the right thing.
That was senior White House advisor Stephen Miller this morning on Fox and Friends, saying that there's still a chance for President Donald Trump to be declared the winner in an election he lost by 74 electoral college votes and 7 million votes nationwide. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We're going to get to the Groundhog Day style flurry of legal and political activity associated with the president's defeat in a moment. But first, speaking of legal activity, it's always great to share information with listeners about our old pals at the Institute for Justice, which is the national law firm for liberty. IJ's got a podcast you should totally check out called Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. Is that a metaphor? Which tells stories about individuals fighting to secure their rights, and along the way teaches you lessons about the law and the Constitution and so forth. You'll hear firsthand from the attorneys, researchers, plaintiffs. You'll get riled up about government overreach, and hopefully you'll be inspired to fight abuse. You can find Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice on all the usual podcast places, as well as ij.org/deep-dive. You'll be glad you did. Okay, before we start, one more quick note of just thanks to all of those of you who made our webathon this year by far the most successful monetarily of the 13 webathons that we've done over the years. Holy cow, super wonderful, great comments, great questions that we answered, some of them here, but also just a lot of great money and crypto and stuff. So thank you all. Puts a spring in our step. Okay, let's get some bullet points to get us started. Electoral College electors are meeting all over the country as we speak on C-SPAN, maybe even C-SPAN 3, to make official the votes in November's election, even as the White House prepares various Hail Mary maneuvers, as referenced at the top. Speaking of which, a federal district court judge in Wisconsin rebuffed the Trump campaign Saturday, not just on the usual kind of technicalities of legal standing, but on the evidentiary merits. That plus the Supreme Court's 9-0 ruling on Friday night, sort of dismissing the Texas Kraken lawsuit, means that Trump and his allies, if my count is correct, are now one win and 59 losses in court since the election. That hasn't stopped more than 100 members of Congress, including GOP leader Kevin McCarthy, the Bakersfield Comet, and several members of the once libertarian adjacent House Freedom Caucus, and 18 Republican state attorneys general, all from signing their names to a petition in support of these challenges. Noted constitutional conservative and lawyer Senator Ted Cruz also volunteered to argue Trump's case in front of the Supreme Court. He sadly will not have that chance. There have been a bunch of pro-Trump demonstrations around the country. Rallies, things got a little stabby in D.C. over the weekend. The president himself is tweeting that, quote, swing states that have found massive voter fraud, which is all of them, that's my all caps voice, cannot legally certify these votes as complete and correct without committing a severely punishable crime, unquote. Totally normal. Sorry for the long preamble, Catherine. That means you have to start paying attention now. I would like you to play with me, Catherine, a game of either Mad Libs or Match Game 77, probably Match Game 77, as we attempt to assess, I think for the third time on this podcast, what this continuing post-election behavior of Trump and his allies means for the country and for the Republican Party. So here goes. Fill in the blank at the end of the sentence, Catherine. Here's the sentence. A GOP that is still signing loyalty oaths to Trump's evidence-free legal challenges is a political party that blank.
Makes me sad. That's my answer. I feel sad about it. I mean, I do. I was thinking, you know, I've started to, and I think much of the country, this is true, started to space out a little bit. Like by challenge 59, you're like, okay, it seems like this isn't going to work, but I guess they're still doing it. It's my job to pay attention. And I appreciated this weekend that Jacob Sullum really kind of snapped me back with his post focused on Ted Cruz's role in this. You mentioned him in the opener. And I got to say, this is like confession time from me. I have somewhere, for some reason, this small bit of hope that Ted Cruz is going to turn out to be okay. And I don't know why. Like, where is that coming from? Maybe it's the Princess Bride references. Maybe it's the Doctor Strange beard. Like, there's just a little
Zodiac killer.
He's goofy. He's a little goofy in a way that kind of calls to me. And so I keep thinking, like, maybe this is the day that Ted Cruz turns it all around and really gets on the side of right. And it's not. Today's not the day. It's not the day. And, you know, what Jacob Sullum did this weekend is just quote Ted Cruz on Donald Trump extensively from 2016 and then contrast that with Ted Cruz's apparent willingness to go to the Supreme Court on the back of a legitimate reputation as someone who has argued before the court in the past and make absolutely preposterous arguments. And so I think this is, you know, we talked a little bit a couple weeks ago.
There's also an extensive passage of quotes from constitutional experts, including many on the right.
It's just a great litany. Like it's just a big old roundup. I think it's just good to think about which grudges need holding. And we talked about that a little a couple weeks ago. But I sort of recurringly sort of kind of want to maybe hope that Ted Cruz will get it together. And I think we are now at the place where the grudges need holding. I particularly liked in the Texas, in the dismissal of the Texas claim, which Cruz was going to argue, the phrase that Texas has not demonstrated a judicially cognizable interest in the manner in which the state conducts its elections, which I don't know what that term means, but it sounds so
It's exactly what Charles Nelson Reilly said of
cognizable.
Yeah, Matt Welch.
Thank you for recognizing.
Can we bring it
pain
back to the whoopee? Like, I mean, that's what you were looking for, Matt, right? The blank.
I wanted someone to make whoopee. Just anybody, please.
Yeah. It's just like, I think it's SCOTUS for like, that don't make no sense. But I really liked
Nick,
it.
You're our House Trumpist whisperer. So what are you currently telling people who are coming back to you with, hey, man, we're just still asking questions. And did you see the Dominion machines? And there's this video from the one time that did that deal.
Man, I'm still working through the receipts on the Diebold machines that gave George W. Bush the Ohio election in 2004. So it's going to be a while before I catch up to Dominion. No, Trump lost the election. He lost from every possible angle. This is like the one there is not a multiverse in which Donald Trump won this election. I'm curious to see how long this plays out. The one thing that I will say is I'm comforted by a couple of things. One is the rapidity with which anybody who is not professionally kind of entailed to follow politics is still worried about Donald Trump and about Donald Trump not leaving. You know, he's going to glue all the keyboard keys that the Clinton people glued down in order to screw over George W. Bush, you know, blah, blah, blah. Trump is finished as president. I think everybody, with the exception of the professional worrying class, understands that. So that's one point. A second point is that all of the constitutional checks are holding, all of the institutional checks are holding. The Supreme Court, Most of the state legislatures, even in the states where the legislatures or the electors, where the process is overseen by Republicans, are saying, get the F out here. We're going to deliver our votes under armed guard or not. But, you know, that is all holding really well. And then the third point is that Rick Perry forgot to mention a third thing in 2010 or something like that in a well-remembered debate, which is going on his tombstone. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that this is bad. It's bad because Trump has forget Trump. I mean, people like Ted Cruz. Catherine, I'm glad that you have come over to the side of sanity on Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz generationally represents the future of the Republican Party. And if the Republican Party is willing to spend a lot of time doing this, I worry what they're going to come up with when they actually turn their, you know, massive brain power to a legislative agenda, when they regroup after they, you know, everybody acknowledges that Trump has lost, Joe Biden is sworn in, or Kamala Harris is sworn in, or and Dr. Jill Biden, of course, is, you know, flouting her PhD all over the country like a, you know, a plague. The Republican Party is in bad shape because they don't have anything to believe in. I don't think this is a constitutional threat. It's certainly not an existential threat to the nation. It's kind of a moment for us to feel good about things, but it's not good.
Peter, you shared an alarming New York Times piece, I think, over the weekend with the headline, Trump allies eye long shot election reversal in Congress, testing Pence. Subhead, some House Republicans plan to try to use Congress's tallying of electoral results on January 6th to tip the election to President Trump. Whew, got me quaking. And then I read down to paragraph 14, which read as follows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is.
It's always paragraph 14, isn't it? Like, the it's never lead. Paragraph... It's never paragraph 9 or even paragraph 23. It's always paragraph 14.
So
where
this
they,
was
they
Mr.
Bury
Brooks meeting the Alabama congressman,
the real news.
Mo Brooks, who's taking up this quixotic challenge, is far from the first lawmaker to try to use the tallying process to challenge the results of a bitter election loss. House Democrats made attempts in 2001, 2005, and even 2017. But they were essentially acts of protest after their party's nominee had already accepted defeat, unquote. So, Peter, as our norms gatekeeper, as our norms watchman, what should be the bipartisan teaching moment right now about capital N norms?
I mean, it's certainly true that much of what the Republican Party is doing right now has an antecedent in Democratic Party kind of resistance efforts over the last 20 years. On the other hand, none of those efforts had the outspoken and strong support of a sitting president of the United States. The Republican Party has taken a lot of what the Democratic Party was doing kind of casually for fun as acts as acts of kabuki resistance and amped that up. And there's still an aspect of this that is a kind of farce that is just totally ridiculous. It's completely pretend, except, of course, that it's not like almost everything in the Trump administration. It's this effort is self-parodying, except to those who view it as deadly serious, which includes the people who really hate Trump and the people who really love him. It is, in some ways, sort of the most unserious, serious threat you can imagine. You know, and the people who are backing this, the Stephen Millers and Ted Cruz's and Mo Brooks's and et cetera's of the world, are hacks and fools and both at the same time, right? I mean, they're kind of, it's like the question that keeps being raised here is, are these people really just that cynical or are they that stupid? And obviously the answer is both. They're malicious idiots. And the party is built around malicious idiocy right now. That's what the Republican Party has become. As Nick says, they don't have anything else that they stand for. They're just a sort of Trump reality show operation. And I am heartened, as Nick is, by the fact that the checks are holding. But I also think that there's limits to that as a way of dismissing this. You know, if the steel roll cage on your four-wheeler doesn't collapse after you flip the thing by ramming into a garbage truck on a drunken bender, and you get out and you say, well, I didn't get hurt, you don't say, hey, that was great, it worked. The safety features. We don't have to worry about this. I'm going on another drunken bender and ramming into a garbage truck again. I don't know. Maybe Nick does. But you don't think, well, that's fine. Everything worked okay. There's no problem. You think, no, I drunkenly drove my four-wheeler into a garbage truck on a drunken bender.
The specificity
bender.
Of that yeah. example is
keep saying drunk.
Pretty yeah. interesting.
Is it a private garbage
suspicious.
Truck
from Florida?
Or is it a municipal garbage truck? I think that's what's really important.
I think now we're asking the right questions. So, you know, it's a real black mark it's a black mark on the eye of the Republican Party. And I think that it tells us a lot about where the party is going to go in the future. I am not worried that Trump won't step down on January 20th. I am worried that the kind of undercurrent of illegitimacy that he and Republicans are promoting here will continue to destabilize things for years to come.
Isn't, if we accept Nick's premise that the institutions held, and there's been some commentary just from today. David French had a piece in Time magazine basically making that argument. Yuval Levin in one of those various kind of dispatch bulwark
the national
persuasions.
National periodical.
I had a similar argument. If it is true that the institutions held, and this is part of it, didn't they hold in part because some of the institutional right, for example, conservatives or center rights or whatevers, took their jobs as grown-ups seriously. Put another way, the Federalist Society gets whooping from lots of people, including Joe Biden, many times over his long and storied career, Senate Judiciary Committee. But as you know, these horrible people who just want to rubber stamp Republicanism. But didn't the Federalist Society kind of do a good job about saying, hey, look, these are some good judges that maybe you ought to appoint, and they're appointed. And when it time came, they judged well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the emphasis on the fact that the Supreme Court, but also lower courts, stocked by Trump or other Republicans are consistently rejecting these claims has been mostly framed as a gotcha, like, ha ha, even your Republican judges won't side with you. But it's actually a reminder that not all Republicans are Trumpists. I mean, it's secondarily a reminder that not all Republican appointed judges are pro-Republican, as we have seen over and over again in ways that really are delightfully confounding to people who see the entire political universe through the two-party system. But more importantly, it's not always about whether you are pro or anti Donald Trump. There are a lot of other, even if you're just doing binaries, there are a lot of other binaries to view the world through. And one of them is constitutional and unconstitutional. One of them is peace promoting or, you know, chaos promoting. And I think that, you can choose which side of all those binaries you're on, but it's a good reminder that pro and anti-Trump isn't the only one, wasn't historically the only one for the GOP. It is certainly true that people like Ted Cruz are operating largely in that binary right now. It doesn't have to be that way forever. And that's not just the Never Trumpers we're talking about. It's also, I think there's a silent majority of sane Republicans. I really believe that. And they'll come back. We'll see them again. They're just being silent right now.
Ross Douthat had a good column over the weekend in which he argued that for now, at least, the dividing line in the Republican Party is people who have to take responsibility for their actions, and that everybody who has had to take responsibility for their actions. So that's, say, Governor Brian Kemp in Georgia. That's the Supreme Court justices who had to decide these cases, all the Trump-appointed judges who have ruled on these cases. Everyone who has to take responsibility has basically behaved responsibly. And the people who have not behaved responsibly are the people who are just acting performatively as if politics is entirely a reality show without consequences.
If I may, there's also something, a larger picture here that is kind of strange and wonderful and interesting, which is that so you have a Republican Party, which, as Peter talks about, is, you know, at the national level is wholly symbolic. It's performative. It's BS. It's Ted Cruz looking like Hugh Jackman's fatter, dumber brother. He's the Ozzie Canseco of Hugh Jackman fictional brothers, right?
Wait, are you saying Ted Cruz is the greatest showman?
Yeah, he's like plus a couple of years and about 50 pounds, right? But in this election, the Democratic Party lost seats in Congress at the legislative level, you know, at the state legislative level.
Did you see the Kevin McCarthy tweet?
Well,
he tweets out a photo of himself in an empty hall with the caption, "Here's a photo of me with all the Republicans in the House who lost their elections this year."
So this is, let's, give a cheer to the American people, because this election, you know, is shaping up more and more as kind of a great outcome, which is that the extreme parts of the Democratic Party, the dumb parts of the Republican Party, were kind of confounded. It's not enough to, you know, the status quo is not good. The status quo before Donald Trump was terrible. We have a lot of work to do, but the American people here are kind of making a pretty good showing of themselves, where they're, you know, they're refusing to take the bait into either of the dumbest versions of each major party. And now the work becomes, you know, how do we as libertarians, how do we combat the worst elements of Joe Biden's platform and his, you know, his things that he wants to get done? And he's assembling an Arkham's asylum of like shitty retreads from the Obama administration and before. I mean, like, do we really need Susan Rice to have her, you know, final turn, as a horrible administrator and bureaucrat? I don't think so. But we also have to push the Republicans to actually maybe think twice about going back to libertarian ideas, because remember, that was all chucked out because the libertarians had taken over the Republican Party and brought them to this horrible point where, you might legalize some drugs, you might pull troops out of Afghanistan, you might actually open up the economy or something. You know, I mean, it's like, so I think, you know, we're in a pretty good place for the last 2 weeks of 2020.
Nick, how do you square your idea that the Trump support is almost entirely a feature of professional political watchers and doers with the protests this weekend, in which a lot of large numbers of kind of pro-Trump folks came out in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere to basically say the results of the election are
fraud? One, Washington, D.C. is a, you know, it's a Potemkin village. There's no question that there are Trump. I hate to tell you this, but you're living on a soundstage. You know, it's the Truman Show. But that was actually a small number of people compared to what we have seen just in the 21st century when you have mass events that actually turn people out. I'm not saying there aren't Trumpists, trolls, dead enders. There's also Antifa and various adjacent groups that are dying to kind of heat all of this stuff. When you look at places like if you have to go to Olympia, Washington, and Portland, Oregon, to find, you know, outbursts of political activity, we're not looking at a mass event. And when I say this, I've talked to, you know, dozens of people. So, take this as it is. But people who are not first and foremost about partisan politics. And over the weekend, I spent a lot of time talking with people who are politically engaged, and they're just not talking about this stuff, because there are more important things going
on. I think that's true to some extent, but amongst self-identified Republicans, you see polls showing that as few as a quarter believe the election
decided. And this may be a cheap way out of this, but I don't think those kinds of questions reveal anything. Are they going to live?
I do agree that the polling is not ideal, right? The way the questions are
but,
asked.
But I mean, how is that going to change how people go about their daily lives, or what? Assuming that they're not just simply telling a pollster go fuck yourself.
One way to transition both from this segment of the conversation and also in thinking about the question as a whole is that I think the lived-in experience of human beings in this country right now is way more about how to deal with COVID and the restrictions than it is about anything else by a factor of a lot. It just affects everything around us. And most of the spare conversations and thoughts are about that and not about whatever Donald Trump and his weirdos are doing. So much happier news today. Today, Catherine Mangue Ward was the first vaccine today. A Long Island nurse, I think, or Staten Island nurse or nurse got jabbed in the arm today. Catherine, please squeal.
I would be delighted to squeal. I'm going to not give you a full squeal so much as like a little, just a little happy lilt. How will that? Is that okay with you? Yeah. So, I mean, we had the footage this morning of a lady getting her jab, as they said in the UK, all of last week in a way that really entertained me. I don't know if y'all saw the story that apparently
they delivered on a bunch of lorries.
Yes, they delivered them on lorries. They carried them up the lifts and then they all got jabs, including an elderly gentleman named William Shakespeare in the UK, who got a lot of, he was trending on Twitter for a while. It's pretty great. New Shakespeare survives, new plague kind of vibe there. I had a moment this morning, which I tweeted about, that when Donald Trump and Nicole Hannah-Jones are side by side in my timeline being like, this is good news. It's like really good news. Or as some people pointed out in reply, really bad news. Like the things that I can think of that would unite those two characters. Like, as you know, I am always a skeptic of bipartisan anything. In general, I like things to be kind of transpartisan, pan-partisan, nonpartisan, whatever word you want to use. When sort of the schmoes of the two parties agree, it's typically bad for liberty. But this is another thing. This is people who really don't agree, and they agreed that this was good. So I also agree that this is good. I have tremendous fears about vaccine backlash, about people being kind of statistically illiterate in how they assess side effects and deaths that occur post-vaccine that might be unrelated to the vaccine. Ron Bailey has been writing some stuff about this in an attempt to kind of get ahead of some of that. I am worried about that. But this morning, I think we can take a hot minute and just be happy that Americans are getting a vaccine for the virus that has totally wrecked our lives for a whole year.
Peter, logistically, what happens next? Who goes to the front of the line? Where do they park the fridges? How do the other vaccines, are we getting more of them? Just give us a, dumb it down for me, if you can, of like, what is the logistical next steps?
Man, nobody could possibly dumb it down enough for you to understand.
Peter can explain to me what ice you use in cocktails, so everything is possible. Peter?
As is so often the case in life, ice is really important, not only in your cocktails, but in vaccine distribution. It's really true. So the first vaccine to roll off the production lines and be approved here is also the one that has the most logistically complicated storage requirements, which is that it needs to be kept at something like 90 degrees below zero, and you have to have these special dry ice packs, and the vaccine only lasts a certain number of days inside those packs and has to be kept at this very low temperature the entire time before it is administered to people. But right now, the first batches are going to come, going to start being delivered to hospitals and to other places. And then those batches are going to be distributed by state, and then states will be largely responsible for the operational sort of movement of getting that vaccine out to people. And it's going to start with frontline healthcare workers. And that makes a lot of sense. And then it is going to move out to people who are vulnerable. So that means people who are quite older or who have some sort of comorbidity. And then after that, it will be the other folks, and probably ending pretty much with me. I on pretty much any scale of need, someone like me who has no kids, doesn't have an older person living in the house with them, is younger, relatively healthy, doesn't have any comorbidities, et cetera, is just about the last person on that list. And people like me, if things go well, can expect to get a vaccine somewhere in the May-June range. Now, this initial round of vaccines takes two shots, as does the other one that is based on this mRNA technology. They're spaced about 3 or 4 weeks apart. It depends on which vaccine you're getting. So there's going to be some scheduling uncertainty in terms of if you are, say, set for a June vaccination. it's not entirely clear yet whether that means you'll get your first dose on June 20th and you won't really get your second one and be immunized until July 20th. And then you may have to wait a week or two afterwards for it to actually kick in. And on the second doses, a thing that people are going to need to watch out for is those second doses are going to, in many cases, give you symptoms that feel remarkably like COVID for a day or two. You will feel a little bit sick for somewhere between 24 and 72 hours, in many cases, not all. But basically, we're looking at a 6 to 7 month timeline here for rolling out the vaccine. Most people who have high need are supposed to be able to get that vaccine by March. And most of the rest of us, adults in particular, are supposed to be able to get a vaccine by May or June. My guess is that there's going to be, even for folks who are not resisting the vaccine, who want to get it, that there's going to be stragglers and it's going to really be an effort that takes through the entire summer. And we're looking probably more like the end of July or August before the vaccine is really available to every single person who actually wants to take it.
You know what's making me like lightly stabby? And this is like very specific to my personality, I realize, but I keep seeing people like saying in news stories and tweeting, hey, look at this chart that shows that even after just the first shot, the vaccine is pretty effective. Like maybe we should just give everyone one shot and then we could be done twice as fast. And it's like, it's the perfect example of like the worst meeting we've all been in, where like at the end of the meeting, someone says a thing that obviously everyone had already thought about and rejected for good reasons. And then you have to go over them again. Like I'm feeling an odd bit of sympathy for like public health authorities right now, because the idea of like, what if we just gave everybody like an untested dosing like schedule of half as much vaccine? Like, have you thought of that?
And so we should talk about that just a little bit, because it's actually kind of an interesting.
But people aren't going to go back, right? Yeah. There's going to be a bunch of people who do that DIY. And I don't know how that's
whether they intend to or not. I mean, the scheduling, right? So a potential logistical complication is just going to be, what if they make enough vaccines to get everybody dose number one? And then there's a problem in the production line. And the second dose that is supposed to be there 3 or 4 weeks later isn't there for people. And maybe they have to take it 5 or 6 weeks later. We haven't done extensive testing about what the range of time is that you can take that second dose. But the reason people are interested in converting to a one dose system is because, in fact, if you look at the study results, it found that it found unexpectedly that a single dose does appear to have a pretty good effect. The thing is, they weren't testing for that. And so this is a real problem in a lot of studies, is you have to kind of announce the result you're testing for in advance. You have to say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to look for. And maybe we will find something else that is interesting and that we weren't expecting along the way. But when you find that, you have to go back and retest for that specifically in order to confirm that what you're seeing is not just a kind of statistical mirage that came out of the results. And so I do think that there is a case for perhaps, depending on vaccine availability and willingness to get people to sign up and resources, I do think there may be a case for running a separate test alongside the rollout of the two-shot vaccine, in which they only inoculate people once. However, we shouldn't just switch the plan in the middle of this to a single shot.
Nick, I have had people on the French side of my family come down with the virus and then cycle through it, and then they come in on the other side and are fine, and describe afterwards a feeling of kind of liberation, of elation, like, oh, wait a second. This is behind me now. This kind of like the nerves that I've been walking around with up to now, I can maybe let my guard down now. I know you've had a brush in some, I forget whether it's antibodies or whether you tested positive, whether I'm breaking news here on this podcast.
You are not breaking news. I talk about being COVID, having had COVID and having antibodies almost as much as I talk about having a PhD or being an Eagle Scout, Matt Welch. So it's inescapable. And I just want to point out, I think Dr. Jill Biden, from any perspective, should be at the front of the line for all of this, because she is a doctor. She's married to an important old guy. And, you know, she's really the, you know, the spokesman for a new generation, a whole new dawn in America.
Certainly, on the other side of my family, the American side of the family, I have a lot of people who work in the healthcare industry. And one of the great kind of under talked about bits is how little those people have been getting tested. I've been tested way more times than other people who will go nameless. But so as someone who's gone through this, Nick, now looking at a future in which, you know, in some months, there's going to be a lot of people who feel like they've got their get out of jail free card here. What do you forecast that doing to like the mood of the country? Or is it just going to be, is it going to be a party? Is it just everyone's going to be just dropping X wherever Nick Gillespie is? And might this have some impact on all the kind of lockdown-ish politics and policies that are all around?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things to remember is that the infection fatality rate, you know, the final death percentage of this is going to be somewhere under 1% of people who are infected actually dying from it. I don't think a lot of things are going to change from what pretty early on was, you know, became a kind of conventional wisdom about this. The wild card has always been the response to this. And what I worry about actually with the vaccine on, not on the horizon, I mean, it's actually being rolled out now, is that for the next 6 months and or longer, because you have people like Bill Gates saying, you know what, bars and restaurants should be closed all of next year. Because, you know, Bill Gates, it doesn't really matter to him if restaurants are open. He can probably buy and open a restaurant in his backyard anytime he wants. But it's actually what happens between now and a time, it's not clear when that will be, where we say, okay, you know what, we can open things up again. Reason, and I believe it was by Jacob Sullum, who's getting a second mention here, had an excellent piece about how the health officials in charge of California's banning of outdoor dining have publicly and openly admitted that banning outdoor dining has, as a policy, has no basis in science. So what I'm worried about as much as anything is, we're, you know, so we have a vaccine. That's good news. That will help a lot of people. It will inoculate the, you know, the frontline medical workers, as well as older people, people at high risk. That's all fantastic. What is the effect between now and whenever we say enough people are inoculated, we can open the country up again? What are the policies going to be? And I actually think counterintuitively that what we're going to see between now and whenever that magical date appears, we're going to see more and more severe lockdowns that are going to screw up the economy and have long lasting, but not always immediately explicit results. And that bugs the hell out of me. To go to your more specific point, it feels pretty good to have had COVID and to have gotten through it. I had, you know, a week of discomfort. My girlfriend also had something similar and has lost her sense of smell, you know, since then. So, you know, there, it's not like it's without cost or anything, but it feels good to have gone through COVID and weathered it and you come out the other side, which is, again, and I'm not minimizing anything here, but it's like, that's the overwhelming experience. I recently was at an event, or not an event, a gathering with my ex-wife and her husband, whose mother is 85 years old, was in a nursing home and had COVID and is doing well. So, you know, these you feel better when you've had COVID and you're on the other side and you feel good about it.
I mean, I think that's a real thing we need to worry about, right? Like that when politicians... that coming out of this, politicians are not going to relax lockdown rules. Instead, they are going to amplify them and find new reasons to use them, right? Like politicians don't give up the tools of power that they have granted to themselves very easily. When all you have is a lockdown, everything looks like a pandemic. And I actually think that the vaccine, at roughly the pace that we expect it to, it should allow us to open up much more quickly than before, than once everyone has had it. Like I don't need to have had the vaccine for us to open stuff up, because what we want to do is we want to immunize frontline workers, vulnerable people, older people. And when they are immunized and largely protected, then that takes away a huge amount of the argument for not doing stuff and for keeping people from meeting, which is, right, like the argument for me not going to a bar isn't so much, hey, Peter, you're going to die. The argument is, when a lot of people like you go to bars, what we see consistently is that those people help spread COVID within the community, and eventually it trickles out and affects people who are vulnerable and are susceptible. Well, if those people can actually be protected via a vaccine, which is something that we should be able to do by February, March, April or so, then it should make it much easier for everybody else to go about their normal lives. I worry very much that politicians are not going to see it that way.
Yeah, and we are talking about, again, to go back to the example of California, you know, we're talking about a policy that was put in place that has no basis in science, but is a real, you know, foot on the throat of the economy. In a state run by a guy who flouts his own laws in all sorts of ways. And there's a lot of state legislators who are doing this, and mayors and things like that in similar ways. So I think that's the real challenge kind of going forward.
We're going to look at some Biden administration developments here in a second. But first, are you looking to diversify your retirement portfolio with currency instruments that are not tied to national governments? If you are like me, the answer is yes. Also, if you are like me, you don't really know how to turn on your own computer, let alone figure out this newfangled technology stuff, this is why BitTrustIRA.com exists. BitTrust IRA helps people who want to get into crypto and blockchain, but don't necessarily want to learn entire new languages and secret handshakes in the process. So go to BitTrustIRA.com/reason, and they'll waive their usual $50 fee. You'll learn about their unlimited trading platform, super low fees, and more. That is BitTrustIRA.com/reason. Visit today. You'll be glad you did. Our podcast advertisers are solely responsible for their content and views, which do not necessarily represent the views of Reason. For making any investment, listeners should seek independent financial, legal, tax, and regulatory advice, preferably not from Nick Gillespie. Okay, so we have done a bad job so far of decentering Trump, to quote one of the latest idiotic journalistic media navel-gazing fads. So let's recenter the president-elect, the old fella who's going to be our 46th president next month. Catherine, since last we podcasted together, who or what has the president-elect done or appointed or trial ballooned that to you is worthy of analytical note?
I am not getting over the Lloyd Austin kerfuffle. Like, I'm not getting over this. So just to review, this is Joe Biden's pick to run the Pentagon, a 4-star general, retired Lloyd Austin. Here's the thing. Civilian control of the military is just bomb as hell. It is a great idea. I love civilian control of the military.
Bomb.
Literally bomb as hell. And it's we've made exceptions in the past. Those exceptions were a mistake. Joe Biden woke up the morning of yet another day of being a almost kind of sort of president-elect and said, you know what? Things are really tense. Things are pretty tricky. I think not only am I going to switch at the last minute from the lady that everybody thought I was going to pick, but also I'm going to do this so that he now functionally needs the approval of both the House and the Senate to put this man on his cabinet. Don't do it, girl. Like, just don't do it. It's not a good idea. It's fully avoidable. So, you know, I guess I just think there's common sense in it, civilian control of the military, but there's also just it's a mindset issue, right? If you are career military, the way you think about your job, the way you think about what you are supposed to do is very different than if you are a career policymaker, advisor, civil servant, wherever you're coming from in the civilian side. The question you are asking yourself every day as a general is not the question that we want the person in with the president talking about war making to be asking himself. Now, I'm sure Lloyd Austin is a smart dude and he can, you know, shift his framework a certain amount. But there's a better and easier way, which is just to appoint a civilian for that role. Oh, my God, Joe Biden, this was an easy one. Why did you screw it up?
Because he's Joe Biden and he's a man barely alive. And we broke the norm, Catherine. You know, Trump broke the norm, and look how well it turned out for him. So I want to ask everybody here before I go into my pick, who I've already kind of flash flashed earlier in the show, which is Susan Rice as Biden's choice of director for White House domestic policy.
Don't flash Susan Rice.
But the AP has a headline which says, Biden, colon, cabinet picks from Obama era mean bold new thinking. And it's in quote marks. And like, is the AP the goddamn funniest, driest troll in history? Or
step aside. Yeah,
no,
Babylon
I mean, like
B.
that is, and it is incredible. You know, the number of retreads from an administration that had the good fortune of being sandwiched between George W. Bush and Donald Trump. So looks good by comparison, but actually was kind of terrible. You know, destroyed the Democratic Party during the years that Obama was in power, reduced the standing and love of America throughout the world. It kept us embroiled in ongoing and new, you know, fights overseas and things like that. Just very strange.
Peter, it's true, as the AP and Nick both point out, that you can't spell bold without Vilsack. Tell us who you're excited about,
God,
Peter.
Put it on
is
a bumper
that a
sticker.
Question?
Put it on a bumper sticker.
Yeah. I mean, I no, my pick is in some ways is Tom Vilsack, but it's also what Tom Vilsack represents,
bold,
which
thinking.
Is what Nick said, which is the way that Joe Biden is determined to bring back the Obama administration. This is what we're seeing now from the Biden picks. I mean, it reminds me a lot of the first act of the Blues Brothers, which you have to understand is really just an elaborate homage to the Seven Samurai. That's another podcast. But Biden's on a mission from God. He saw the light and he is going to put the Obama administration back together. So you've got Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture. Again, you've got Vivek Murthy, who was Obama's Surgeon General. Wouldn't you know, he is up for the same job under Biden. You've got Ron Klain, who worked for Biden in the Obama administration. According to a Washington Post analysis, about 80% of the picks so far for the Biden administration have the word Obama on their resume somehow or another. This is just Obama administration 2 without Obama officially at the top of it.
Nick, who is the Donald Duck Dunn of this administration, and does she have a doctorate?
You know, I'm just going with Susan Rice. I think she was, you know, who is going to be the horse whisperer to Joe Biden, who, you know, it's just, it's bad. It is bad. I mean, Joe Biden is going to have at best, a really mediocre run as president. And I think, you know, as we
I'm here for mediocre, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, as we approach these points where, you know, large entitlement trust funds are running out of money, where significant changes can be made that will spare us the worst of all sorts of economic, social, cultural outcomes, we're not going to get that. And I think that is embodied in somebody like Susan Rice, who was very influential in a variety of roles in the Obama administration, particularly as national security advisor, or playing that role. She will not be, she doesn't have to be confirmed by Congress, by the Senate, but she has a really bad track record and she's getting another shot. It's like, Matt, you'll, I think, enjoy this, but she's like the Jean Mauck of political appointees, where she, you know, at a certain point was given a really good hand and then screwed it up and then went,
that's
like, just continued
to
get job after job after job with better and better teams and still could barely muster, you know, a 500 season in baseball. Just this
I
is
will
so
brook
bad.
No
so
dissent
bad.
About my fondness for the little general. And by that, I don't mean
Thomas Stephen Douglas.
Since Nick mentions the old age entitlements, we should just note that
Suderman.
One thing
Suderman's
here.
Like,
yep,
ooh,
Matt, sorry.
I got to do it.
Yep, that one thing the Biden, the Obama administration retread means is the appointees are old. The average age of a Biden appointee so far is 63. those people are all going to work until they're like 90 years old. That alone is a reason to raise the rate.
What do you think about 63 being old?
Now, I think it's, you know, they're barely getting started, but do it in the private sector. I mean, this is, there is a revolution, you know, and I say this as somebody who was born in 1963. My father was born in 1923. You know, the difference between him turning 50 and me turning 50 is, you know, there's a world of difference. I wrote a column for the Daily Beast about how, irrespective of their politics, in 2016, it was kind of great that, you know, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were really freaking old, but that wasn't the primary question. Having said all of that, there is something in American political culture, not, you know, it's not in culture, and it's not in economic culture or, you know, commerce and things like that. We have a gerontocracy. And the problem isn't that they're old. It's that their ideas are old and they sucked when they were 40 years old. I mean, Joe Biden was a disaster as a senator, you know, in 1969 and 1999 and 2009. And he's going to be a disaster as a president because his ideas suck. And they're old. They're an old man's idea of what matters and what is good for the country. We had a, you know, we saw Donald Trump come in with a bold set of insane ideas. Some worked, most didn't. We actually need bold new thinking, not old people who are getting their second, third, or fourth shot at screwing up the country.
Speaking of old thinking, I just noted with a particular acidic taste in my mouth that there was a joint Washington Post op-ed, which is always a bad sign, from the superintendents of the nation's three largest school districts, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. I'm just going to read the headline. We need a Marshall Plan for our schools, and we need it now. That's the kind of bold new thinking. It's going to be like,
I strongly disagree. I think we need a moonshot for our schools.
I want a Yalta conference for our schools. Let's just divide them up, you know.
What if we had a Marshall Plan for COVID and a moonshot for
our
schools?
How about a Munich Plan for schools where we just give up and leave the people who run them? You get to run them, but we're taking our money and we're going elsewhere. Tyler Cowen, who may not care to remember this, but he wrote a great piece or an economic analysis of the Marshall Plan, by the way. And the fact of the matter is that the countries that received the most funding from the Marshall Plan, their economies thrived when the Marshall Plan stopped. Because, and this, I'm bringing it up because it's relevant here, with great money, you know, to paraphrase Spider-Man, with great money comes great entanglements. And, you know, the U.S. government was micromanaging a lot of the economies of Europe while they were doling out massive amounts of money. And it's when they pulled back from that, that the German economic miracle happened, things like that. Schools don't need more money. They don't need more insight and direction from D.C. They need less than that. There's a revolution going on in schools. And like all of the good parts of our lives, it's about dispersion. It's about decentralization. It's about reducing decision making to the individual level or as close to that as possible, not aggregating it in a bunch of ossified structures that have failed. Again, like the Biden administration's, you know, in all of their earlier iterations that have just failed time and time again.
As always, when we mention the Marshall Plan, I like to point out that a key and under-metaphored part of it was to encourage very strongly the creation of a free trade bloc within the recipient nations as part of it being a bulwark against communism, both in terms of creating more prosperity, but also it's free trade, dude. It's not communism. We want to make sure that Western Europe doesn't go the commie way. Okay, let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, do you want to go first?
Sure, I will go first, even though my recommendation is mildly embarrassing, which is that I didn't consume anything like high-end or worthwhile at all. I rewatched some Avatar The Last Airbender. I don't know. That's where I am.
Yeah.
That's the place I am in 2020
yes.
right now. But y'all, it's a good show. I did not watch it as a youth, because I'm too old, I think, and I sort of started it when it came out on Netflix, and it is available to anyone who has Netflix. You can just stream it and enjoy it. There's some good stuff in there. There's some good stuff about having bad politics and then figuring out how to have better politics. There's some stuff about the corrupting influence of power. But I will admit, I was watching it at least in large part for a little bit of perspective on sibling dynamics. 2020, my kids have really been up in each other's faces. And the Katara-Soka relationship is actually a very, very realistic one, especially compared to lots of other siblings in fiction. Do I love that literally everything my children and all children of this generation are consuming is the adults have abandoned you, politics are bad, you have to start a revolutionary something and save the world? No, don't love that. Do I think it might be true? Yes, I do. Avatar: The Last Airbender. Recommend.
Nick, what...
Do you know who worked on that show who is of interest to our recommendations? Is Dave Filoni, who is the mastermind behind the Star Wars cartoons, Star Wars Clone Wars and Rebels, and is now an executive producer on The Mandalorian and directed the Ahsoka episode.
As you said, another podcast. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I read Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions, which is by Ben Powell and Alex Noreset of Cato, and I think I butchered his last name there. It's a fantastic look at the new arguments, the new economic and political arguments against mass immigration, particularly the idea that when you bring in people from shithole countries, and you know most people by definition are leaving a what they consider a worse place for a better place when they emigrate to the U.S., they bring, you know, the old kind of Reaganite pro-immigration thing was, you know, immigrants bring one mouth but two hands. So it's a net benefit. The new one is that these people show up here and they bring nothing except their horrible institutions and attitudes from the old country. Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions, looks empirically at the economic arguments in favor of immigration, including those economic arguments worked out by many people who are now anti-immigration, even though their own economic arguments support the idea that there's a mass benefit. And they also look at some of those political structures and find that immigration is good for everybody. Arguably the only people who get stiffed by it are the people who stay behind. But actually, there's even some benefits to that because they, you're stuck in a bad place, but you have kind of more room to breathe. So I highly recommend Wretched Refuse?
Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I've been playing Cyberpunk 2077. Just like a lot of you, I've been looking forward to this game for a long time. It is certainly the biggest, most hyped video game of the year, broke sales records, had a record number of, helped drive a record number of players on Steam, the big PC video game platform, over the weekend. So there were more than 1,054,000 concurrent players. And that was largely driven by people playing Cyberpunk. The game's gotten some negative press because of glitches and bugs. It was delayed a bunch of times, in part because they just wanted to smooth out the gameplay experience and released it. It seems pretty clear before it was completely ready for primetime. But I gotta say, I love the game. I have found some glitches for sure, but nothing game-breaking. Just some kind of clipping errors, and sometimes my avatar just doesn't seem to have hair, which is sort of, you know, a thing in one of these games where, like, you have to spend, like, a full hour designing the look and backstory and, like, voice, and in this case also quite detailed genital choices of your player character. It's a thing. It's real. But I've been playing it, and it's great. And, you know, one of the other complaints that people have had, that critics at least have had, is that it is a throwback to kind of 1980s William Gibson era cyberpunk ideas. And that's true. And that's, like, not a bad thing at all.
I was going to say, just, sounds like a recommendation to me.
It dives into that era of cyberpunk idea and culture, and like in a really interesting way. But I think it also does update it and it does modernize it, particularly when it comes to sort of body issues and some of that sort of stuff. And I'm really enjoying the game, the kind of the expanse of it, the freedom of it. I don't think I have ever seen a video game world that is quite as open, quite as complex, and quite as realistically populated. And so because it takes place in this big city, there's just this weird thing that you get to do is you get to like run around a kind of operational and fully populated city in a way that you can't in real life right now. And so there's this kind of strangely liberating and freeing virtual experience that you get from playing a game like Cyberpunk 2077. And also, like, it's really cool, and the systems are neat, and the story is actually pretty engaging, and the voice acting, which includes a big role for Keanu Reeves, is really pretty great. This is what I want video games to be. It is a little bit glitchy, but highly recommend it for anybody who likes video games, William Gibson, or running around cool science fiction cities.
One of the great ancillary outcomes of that is it sparked a mini boomlet in Billy Idol's 1993 album Cyberpunk as well, which I've seen a bunch of people referencing it when the game came out. And it is a great, like the future itself, it is a great failed experiment. And I would much rather be living in the era that you're talking about, Peter, where there is both fear and anxiety, but mostly hope and and experimentation in a future that is gonna kind of be great and kind of suck at the same time compared to what we have now.
The game also describes how to make a cocktail named after the Keanu Reeves character, a Johnny Silverhand. And so obviously I will be making Johnny Silverhands this weekend.
Speaking of silver, I watched, speaking of silver bells, I watched Elf recently. Should be a holiday tradition. Still holding up, in case you haven't seen it in a long time. Don't listen to Nick.
In 20 years or something? When did that
like
movie 15 come out,
Matt? Years ago, I think. Will Ferrell.
It came out, I can tell you exactly when it came out, because it has a narwhal in it. And a while back when I did my Twitter thread about how narwhals were invented in 2005, many, many people noted that actually Elf came out the year before and has a narwhal, and that's when narwhals were invented. So take that as you will.
Prominently featured. So anyways, at the in the closing credits of the film, there's a really fetching version I'm blanking on that. Baby, It's Cold Outside. I was going to say, let's call the whole thing off. Baby, It's Cold Outside, with Leon Redbone, who plays the snowman, the Burl Ives snowman in the picture. And he's singing with Zooey Deschanel, who's the actress in the movie. And she sings great. And I just mentioned this, you know, on Twitter. Hey, I saw Elf. It was great. And I really liked the last song. And someone's like, oh, you know, she's got a whole Christmas album thing and linked to it. And sends Matt down the rabbit hole of a group called She and Him, that Zooey Deschanel started with a indie musician, Portland dude named Matthew Ward, who's got a bunch of his own little records. And they're pretty great.
Under the name Ward. M. Ward.
It's pretty great. You can imagine it's a little bit twee. She does get the ukulele out. And as Nick knows only too well, you can only have so much ukulele
hard
in your life.
No, on the ukulele.
She was Mrs.
Ukulele,
Ben.
I think playing the ukulele is what gave George Harrison brain cancer, I'm pretty sure.
Yes. Tom Petty has a funny story about George Harrison ukuleles in the trunk.
I really thought were going to go down a James Caan rabbit hole, because Elf is really a James Caan movie, and that you were going to end up playing rollerball over the weekend with your Fifth Column podcast friends.
Every movie, James Caan movie, is a James Caan movie, and that's only it is. But anyways, so She and Him, they have six records. She's a very nice kind of singer. Reminds me of like Peggy Lee, or like the sort of 50s, they give Miffy Ver type of singing. And they came out with a Christmas album in 2011 called A Very She and Him Christmas. Another one in 2016 called Christmas Party. But the best usage of that is basically just to tell your robot to shuffle Christmas songs by She and Him. And it's great. It's the one that I'm listening to this year. Last year was Gene Autry.
What's the best Christmas song that names Christmas in the title that they do, Matt Welch?
I think it's Christmas Baby. It's called, it's, you know, Christmas songs, like after a while, you just, they're all the same title, regardless of what. Yeah, I think it's Christmas Baby is the one that's made it onto my Spotify list. But they do a perfectly good job of Little Saint Nick, the Beach Boys number. In fact, in their non-Christmas playing, they do a better version of a Beach Boys song than the Beach Boys themselves, which I'm a big BB fan. So that's semi-high
praise. Is it Kokomo? They do a better version of Kokomo? Don't tell me that, Matt Welch.
I Can Hear Music, which they turn into a torch ballad rather than a plaintive cry for cocaine.
How does it compare to other indie rock Christmas records, like the Dave Bazan Christmas?
Couldn't tell you because I don't listen to music made after 2003. But I like this.
Wait, your musical dividing line is the beginning of Narwhals?
Our work is done here. Thank you all for listening. Send me all your Christmas listening ideas on Twitter and elsewhere. I listen to all of our podcasts, including the interview with recent interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays. So
Dr. Nick Gillespie, please. There's a new sheriff in town and they've got a PhD.
And we'll catch you next week. And thanks. Goodbye.